Hello and welcome to Money Control Podcast. Today, we are joined by Saurabh Mukherjee and Anupam Gupta to discuss their new book, The Victory Process. Regular Money Control readers would be familiar with Saurabh, who is founder and chief investment officer at Marcellus Investment and a well-known market guru. Anupam is an integrated equity research analyst, consultant, and he also hosts the award-winning personal finance podcast, Paisa Vaisa. The Victory Project is a book about high performance and how to achieve peak potential. Through intensive research, interviews with very successful professionals in varied fields and so on, Saurabh and Anupam have constructed a handy guide that talks about the practices and behaviors needed to reach peak performance in our professional and personal life. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
My first question is, I think it's something which you would probably have been hearing ever since you published a book. How did this book come about? I mean, what inspired this book?
So I'll go first and I'll share my thoughts. Basically, 2 years ago, Anupam and I were having a cup of coffee, actually very close to Money Control's offices in Lower Parel. And we were discussing one afternoon the previous books that I'd written, especially Unusual Billionaires, and how great promoters, great capital allocators think about growing their businesses over long periods of time. The discussion then moved to thinking about the most successful fund managers in India, a subject I've written about in my 2014 book, Gurus of Chaos. And then Anupam made the observation that if you look across professions, whether it is great promoters, great fund managers, or cricketers, or martial arts fighters, his observation was, are there common strands, common drivers of success, common drivers of outsized success across professions, across various disciplines? And the more we thought about it, we felt the answer was yes, there are. And that in turn led to this desire to say, can we spend some time thinking this through, reading about it, talking to successful people across various fields, to understand what are the common drivers of outsized success across a multitude of disciplines and professions. So 2 years ago, a cup of coffee in Lower Parel, and here we are with the Victory Project, 6 steps to peak potential in our hands. Anupam, you want to share your thoughts as well?
Yeah, so this is a logical extension, Ravi, of excellence, because the people, when you look at Unusual Billionaires, when you look at coffee can investing, it's essentially the same thought process taken to a broader canvas. If you look at Unusual Billionaires, you're looking at a very elite set of eight companies and a few banks that delivered outsized financial performance year after year. And as you would know, predictability and stability of financial performance is something that's actually rare in India. CAGR seems to kind of mask periods of underperformance, of weak performance and strong performance. But there were these companies that actually did well year after year. And the people who led them, their story, the organizations that they built, it was just a very logical thing that if someone is very successful in his or her field, then there have to be some drivers behind it. And we sat and thought about it and we just laid out the framework, met a lot of people, read a lot of books, and we've come up with our own framework to explain this.
And do you think these drivers have become all the more important in this pandemic world which we are living in now?
I think I wouldn't say more important, but I think what the pandemic certainly has done is made everybody rethink, what are we doing in life? Where are we going? And am I using every single day that I have to the fullest possible extent? I think we've met, we published this book around a couple of months ago. We met lots of people through webinars, through podcasts, who've reached out and said, in any case, because of everything that we've been through in the last 6 months, I've been rethinking my priorities in life. And in that context, The Victory Project becomes a very timely book. I have to confess, neither Anupam and I intended that the book would be published during the pandemic. But as it so happens, a book on how each of us can do justice to the talents that we have inside us, that sort of book becomes incredibly sort of poignant in the world that we have lived through over the last 6 months.
Yeah, and I think that the pandemic has just underscored a lot of things that we've written in the book, which is that you need to find something that you love to do and you then find a mentor, achieve mastery. And so it's just underscored that success is rare. I mean, that's That's what it is about. And if you're already in a very competitive environment with this layer of, you know, if the pandemic were not there, you and I would probably be going to our office, and we know what life in Bombay is like. And now that we've been 6 months at home, we probably have forgotten that. But bridges are collapsing, the infrastructure is totally smashed up. So in that pre-pandemic world, in any case, succeeding despite those factors was already tough. And now you've added one more layer over that. So the book actually tells you that there is a way out. And if you follow the structure, there is a reasonable chance that you could achieve success.
Fair enough. So one recurring theme, I found in this book is, you know, start with your goals, identify your goals. And you have even written these goals may not be profound. But how does one go about articulating them? Do you have any examples? Because the average person you meet doesn't seem to have any goals at all apart from, say, survival.
So I'll offer myself as a sort of volunteer in this example process. As you probably know, Ravi, we've sort of spoken several times over the past decade, and by and large, whenever we used to speak, I was a broker, an analyst, you were a journalist. The one time we met in the last 10 years, I was on my way to a business trip. And I remember you telling me you were on your way to, I think, somewhere nice in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, perhaps, right? And for the best part of my professional life, right, I've run from meeting to meeting, from city to city, doing business, earning money from my erstwhile employer, and also, I have to confess, in so doing, earning generous financial rewards for myself. But in that, you know, in that frenetic sort of blur of activity, I was increasingly finding that not only was I missing out on watching my children grow up, not only was I missing out on reading the books that I wanted to read, having the life experiences that I wanted to have, it was also having a serious impact on my health, right? So sitting on economy class seats for hours, you know, packs up your back, I was putting on weight and so on. And it was 4 years ago, I remember sitting back and saying, you know, what do I really want? Is this the life I want? It's getting me some of the financial rewards I've aspired to, but a lot of the other aspects, sort of time to read, time to spend time with my loved ones, looking after my own health, none of that is working out. So how do I get my priorities right in life? It was a process which began 4 years ago. Courtesy this book, courtesy the Victory Project, that process sharpened up a lot more. And in a way, the best way I can sort of restate my priorities in life is sort of to echo a friend of mine in California. He's also a fund manager in California. And he taught me this 2 years ago. He said, look, sort of for me, it's very clear. My priorities are my family, my closest colleagues, and my clients. Right? Those are the three things I prioritize in life. Everything else melts away. So I might be a cricket or a baseball fan, but that's a pretty low down my priority list. My family, my closest colleagues, and my clients, that's what I prioritize. Everything else melts away. So it's taken me till my mid-40s to figure this out. I wish somebody had helped me think this through ideally 20 years ago. But if not that, in my early 30s would have been helpful. And that was in a way that the reason we wrote the Victory Project. We said there are lots of people out there who are talented, who are hardworking, who can do a lot in life if they're able to channel and focus their energies on the right priorities. And the Victory Project is a tool. It's a practical tool. The book is a practical tool intended to help people out there live a life where they do maximum justice to their immense abilities.
So, and from my perspective, I think, Ravi, the thing is that you mentioned the average guy, right? I mean, finding your goal or finding something that makes you happy, now that might even be a luxury for a lot of people that we know. But the book is designed for even small goals. I've given the example of how I learned swimming, you know, from going from the fear of even stepping into water all the way to at least spending 1 hour inside the pool. Or it could be, let's look at the pandemic right now. And a lot of us have had a lot of extra time open up. Now, you could use that to do something that you've always wanted, but you've not had the chance to do, right? I mean, you know, there is learn a language, there is drawing, there's a lot of other skills. So I think the best way to look at it is the case studies that we've taken in the book, that opened the book. One is of a mid-career senior executive of an FMCG firm who was just not able to crack the next level in her firm versus her family. And on the other hand, a 25-year-old who's just started his career and just can't figure his way out of the various complexities that are there in his job. So goals are different for different people. But, you know, whether it's the average guy or whether it's the CEO, having a goal itself is a very good place to be in. The thing is, how do you crack that despite the various hurdles that are thrown to us on a day-to-day basis, which could be in the form of, you know, just spending time on WhatsApp, social media, clutter and all of this to other bigger problems.
Fair enough. So basically you're saying that, I think probably I read this line also, that simplicity is a great competitive advantage to have, whether as a person or as an organization, isn't it? But it is also not an easy thing in modern life.
Absolutely. So in a way, think about it like this. Simplicity as a kind of virtue, as a behavioral habit, obviously, we've known for centuries and millennia in our country, that simple living, high thinking is a very purposeful, very effective way to live. But it hasn't, you know, always been very clear to people, how can simplicity be a practical tool? How can simplicity be a practical tool to succeed in the modern business environment? And that's what we have tried to do in this book. You sharpen simplicity up so that whether you are a journalist, whether you are a cricket player, whether you are a fund manager, sharpen simplicity up so that it becomes a practical tool to live a more fulfilling life, to maximize your potential. And that's where the paradigm comes in, right? We sequence simplicity into sort of six steps.
Right.
Specialize, simplify, spiritualize, clutter reduction, creativity, and collaboration, right? And each of these actually, each step builds on to the other. You can't really say, I'm going to hit the highest levels of creativity in journalism unless you've specialized in a specific facet of journalism. You can't say, I'm going to collaborate from tomorrow morning, I'll be a collaborative person in my organization. It's very difficult to collaborate if you haven't built a degree of emotional maturity through spirituality. So you've sequenced these six steps to turn simplicity into a powerful tool to live a better life.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add that the guests that we have, the experts that we have, the essays that we have after each and every chapter are just exemplifying that, whether it is Professor Sanjay Bakshi, or whether it is Ramdev Agarwal Ji, whether it's Mark Mobius, whether it's Apurva Purohit, whether it's Sanjeev Bijanani, there are always, you can actually see these principles in action in their lives. So you mentioned about simplicity. I think that the chapter on simplicity, actually, we had Professor Sanjay Bakshi in that. And it was a mind-blowing experience because we spent, easily over 3 hours out there, and he showed us his iPhone, which is completely blank on the front screen. Now, that's one aspect of simplicity out there, that you do have technology, but technology doesn't rule you. You decide how much of technology to have in your life. So he didn't have a single notification throughout those 3 hours. And that was a recurring theme in all our guests, that when they gave us their attention, it was completely, it was a total attention. Whereas if you're sitting in your house with your own family, when you're talking with them, there's a very good chance that you yourself are on WhatsApp. You know, so it's just about these small, small tweaks, small, small changes that you can make in your life, which go towards the path of simplicity.
No, that is totally true. I mean, it's not only us, but now I see even the older generation people in their 60s and 70s hooked onto mobile phones.
Yeah, exactly. And we are not making a case that you need to dump technology altogether. Although, we have spoken about a digital detox. But we are giving you examples of people who've incorporated this technology into their lives in a very, very simple way. You do not have to have the latest iPhone. You do not have to, participate in every Amazon sale. You do not have to forward everything that you see on WhatsApp. You don't have to see every video on WhatsApp. All of these are choices that we make. And with the simplicity paradigm, we're saying that you don't need to do all this, really.
Right. Fair enough. So, one line which struck me when I was reading your book was where you have said that both of you are refugees from the corporate world. So, obviously, you gentlemen have walked the talk, what you have written in this book. But can you tell me a little bit about the challenges you face? Because any change is not easy to implement. What are the obstacles did you overcome, for Saurabh to leave where he was and start up Marcellus, and for you to become a successful podcaster?
Anupam, do you want to go first?
Yeah, my story is quite short, actually. So, see, here's the thing, Ravi. I can safely say that, you know, podcasting is not my profession because it's not going to pay for my expenses. You're someone who has your own podcast. So I think you would know the numbers. But the podcasting bit is, you know, it's just one piece of the pie. And it's again something that we've written in the book about how you start something and you be consistent at it and you go on delivering it, you know, over a long period of time to see results from that. So this is my fourth year of podcast, on personal finance. I have crossed 250 plus episodes. I've been just extremely, really lucky to have great guests on the personal finance side and on the listenership side. But is this it? Is this, you know, is this success? No, by no count. Because any field, whether you look at it, whether you take YouTube or whether you take podcasts, you have to have a fairly long period of time and build up a body of work for it to reach somewhere. I have certainly not reached there as yet. And that's not because of the podcast as a medium, but because it's a long process. So you could now, whether you look upon it as a challenge is a different thing. Outside of that, writing is actually where I would say that my main passion is. And I think there I was extremely lucky back in 2014 to meet Saurabh thanks to an ex-boss of mine who was very generous to leave a good word for me with Saurabh. So the challenge is there was the particular skill set that I had to offer was, and the life that I wanted was not easily available to me at that point of time. So obviously there are always going to be challenges that will be thrown at you. But if you persist and go on doing what you feel you are good at, we live in an open economy, in an open market, your talent or your output will be appreciated over a period of time. If it is not, then you go back to deliberate practice. Again, we mentioned that in the book. And this is a theme that you would see in any successful, take Virat Kohli for, you know, just for example, his entire progress in cricket is in front of us. Whether it was the way he toned his body or his strokes, he just kept at it. So there's deliberate practice out there. The same thing you would see with CEOs. You know, so you use those moments of challenges and convert them into opportunities. It is not easy by any measure. By any measure. But the key is to go on doing it.
So you know, you're right, Ravi. I mean, the transition was difficult and the only credit I can claim is I thought it through and I've been very lucky to receive support from two constituencies. One is from my better half. I still remember that 2.5 years ago when we sat down and figured out how much we'd have to cut back on unnecessary expenditures, unnecessary in retrospect. At that time, it felt like very necessary expenditures to live the good life in Bombay. So we pared down what we spend money on. We decluttered our spending habits, so to speak. And I was also lucky in that a whole group of, you know, incredibly talented, committed individuals came together to create Marcellus. And in a way, that drove a lot of our thinking around collaboration. Until Marcellus came together and I realized how small each of us is in the scheme of things and how the individual himself or herself actually can't ever build something extraordinary unless he subsumes himself in a larger whole. So that without the help of my better half, without the help of my colleagues, I don't think Marcellus would be where it is today. So part of the challenge was around that, you know, understanding that to move forward in life beyond a successful job in an investment bank, to move forward in life and build something even relatively modest in size, I need the help, the inputs, the goodwill of many, many people in this city. The other challenge was around just learning to focus. The good part of, you know, good in inverted commas of working in an investment bank is there's always 20 things happening. And you can make yourself feel very busy in the midst of a frenetic blur. When you work in asset management, especially our style of asset management, you just have to spend hours reading, right? You can be reading, say, 10, 15 annual reports for 7, 8 days without doing much else. So learning to concentrate, learning to still one's mind, and just do the same task for a very long period of time was a skill I had to relearn. I'd done it in my college days, but I'd forgotten it in the intervening 20 years in the blur of investment banking. So I retaught myself a whole bunch of skills. Cal Newport's book, Deep Work, was very helpful. And in that process, right? Reading the books which went into the creation of the Victory Project, learning from people like Professor Sanjay Bakshi, people like Harsh Mariwala Saab, they're all inside the book. Their lessons were very helpful. So more than the practical challenges around, you know, cash flow and money and, you know, funding, which is what everybody thinks building a business entails, the harder challenge was the psychological challenge of learning to calm my mind down and focusing on the same task for extended periods of time. But as Anupam explained with the swimming example, as I continued doing it, after the first 6-7 months, life in Marcellus settled into a groove. My mind started settling down, what we call the monkey mind. The monkey was jumping a little less. And we've now reached a stage where a normal day involves half the day of just sitting and reading, either reading books or reading annual reports. And, it's a life I feel far more contented with. You know, that transition took the best part of 3 years, but I'm glad I did it. And the Victory Project, in a way, is as much my journey as the journey of those out there who might buy the book and read.
Yeah, and just to add to Saurabh, Ravi, since he spoke about the swimming point, it's not like I become an ace level swimmer or something. It is just about a tiny goal that was there that I had that I wanted to learn, and it turned out to be so much fun. And it's also a challenge that gets thrown your way, right? Because you're not aware that you can actually do something because you're probably cluttered with all kinds of things in your life. But if you sit and make a routine, you could actually find a lot more time.
Right, right. Another part of your book, I mean, this one of the steps in simplicity paradigm, which I was interested a lot in was, what should you specialize in? The question, how do you find your vocation? That again is it's easier said than done. Do you have any tips for people on, how they should go about it?
A lot of people believe that once you started out, in your early 20s, life is set in stone, you do the same thing for the next 40 years. That paradigm obviously no longer holds true in the modern world of how careers evolve. We are often seeing a lot of people who go through a career change in the late 30s, early 40s, yours truly, for example. And then we are seeing another bunch of people who are also doing another career change in their early 50s, mid 50s, right? So we are often seeing people who have sort of three stages to their careers. What you begin with just after graduating from college, then a mid-career shift, and then in the final sort of 10, 15 years of your career, a third shift where you do something else. Now, from what we can see and what we have written in the book is, at each of these stages of life, when you're committing to something for 10, 15 years, you got to commit to something which you're innately interested in, something which makes your juices flow, with something that you get excited about. If you say, I'm going to do X, Y, Z because there's a lot of money in X, Y, Z, or there's a lot of fame, that is not a logical or a rational strategy, because in whatever field you enter, there's bound to be high degree of competition. And for you to excel, for you to be the numero uno in that field, you have to have a natural inclination to specialize and work incredibly hard at it. And if you are marginally better than your peers, you'll go on to become a superstar, right? The beauty of the economy is that if any of us can produce world-class output, which is marginally better than our peers, the whole world is our oyster. And people like J.K. Rowling are the kind of the finest exponents. Virat Kohli's, the J.K. Rowlings are the finest exponents of this, where they go on to create wealth, fame, fortune, because they are tangibly better than their competitors. Right? And therefore, to do something which innately interests you should be the simplest way to seek specialization, rather than saying, well, there's money to be made in investment banking. Let me enter investment banking. There's money to be made in playing cricket in the IPL. Let me do that. And that sort of thinking doesn't seem to lead very far.
From my perspective, I think that, just to add to what Saurabh said, I think money is an outcome. And this is not something that comes naturally to us, because given the kind of background that we've had, I mean, our economy has only started growing in the last 20, 30 years. Given the kind of background we had, it's very innate in us to say that, okay, once you do your 10th or 12th, you have to choose between science, commerce and arts, and not something that you love. I mean, if I were to go and tell my parents, say 20, 30 years ago, that I want to become a podcaster, they'd give me one slap and they would be justified in that. So there's nothing wrong in that. I'm just saying that now we need to, what we've spoken in the book is money is an outcome, and therefore finding what you love and becoming good at what you do, the and getting rewarded for it from the open market, that kind of a model will probably work better today in India because of the times that we live in being very different from what they used to be. Okay, this concept is still not, I would say it's still not something that's easily acceptable as compared to the traditional model of saying that you follow a career where there is money. And the other thing is that things don't have to be linear. You know, you could start your career in doing something and then figure out after some point of time, probably when you become financially stronger, that you want to actually pursue something that you want to do. And we see that theme a lot in a lot of people also, that they switch careers and then finally they find their groove. So I think that's it from my side, that I would just like to add that money should be an outcome, not a goal.
Fair enough. But we also see people losing their interest in something which they are interested in, say, their late teens, early 20s, and becoming disillusioned, after 10 years of work life. So how does one deal with that?
So I'll jump in there because I'll just quickly, you know, look at this from my perspective, because that's exactly what happened with me also, right? Because I tried my hand at being in the sell side for a very long period of time and it didn't work. I mean, I also went through that period of disillusionment. But the thing is that, again, that's what we've written a lot in the book. You have to look at other tools, whether it is spirituality, whether it is meditation, whether it is anything else that helps you to focus more clearly on your goals and overcome that disillusionment. So, yeah, sort of.
So in a way, this is the central challenge in modern life, right? Because we have a plethora of options open to us, whether it's in, you know, entertainment in the evening, what movies we watch, what careers we pursue, what books we read, right? Because of the plethora of options, boredom sets in far more easily. In our parents' generation, they didn't have the options, and as a result, they had sort of specialization by default rather than by choice, right? Now, how do you take this choice that's available to us and turn it into an asset in your favor, something that makes your career bloom and blossom rather than a curse which results in you zigzagging your way through life? And the best example we can find is find the best sort of tip we can give you is find a guru, right? If you can find a guru who simplifies the path to the top of Mount Everest for you, the guru tells you about his or her own mistakes. The guru gives you productivity hacks. The guru tells you what books to read, what sources to consult. That process of having the right guru guide you through a career in journalism or banking or sports or whatever it is that you're doing, if you get the right guru, it's very difficult to then go astray, right? If even after finding the right guru and finding tutelage and finding success and perfection, you still don't, you know, like it and you're getting bored, then obviously it's time to press the reset button and begin a new chapter in your life. But to make the most of the choices we have and get the, you know, squeeze the most juice out of life, maximize our potential, it's worth trying to see if whatever field you're in, you can find one or two people who can act as your guides through that profession and give you these tips, these contacts, these productivity hacks, these life lessons, which in a way smooth your path as you go up the learning curve.
Would you say that we have a culture of mentorship in India?
I think this is the country which created the Guru Shishya Parampara. We obviously had it once upon a time. My experience in Mumbai, Ravi, over the past 12 years suggests there are people willing to help. In fact, my experiences even in the years I spent in England suggest there are people willing to help. But you do have to have the, humility is not the right word. You have to have the sort of poise, the presence of mind to reach out to these people and say, look, this is who I am. I'm a seeker. I'm seeking knowledge, expertise. Can you please help me? And I've very rarely been turned away in the city. And I honestly say this in, you know, all humility. You and I wouldn't be sitting here with Anupam doing this podcast had it not been for the many gurus who have helped us arise in the world, right? So someone like, say, Mr. Mohandas Pai, to give us time to share his experience of, you know, growing up in Bangalore through the 80s, rising in Infosys through the 90s and noughties, and you know, his experience of life, or say for someone like Nandan Nilekani to be willing to write a review of the book, or for Gursharan Das Ji to write the foreword. These people have no need to be helping us, right? There's nothing we can really give them in return. All we can do is ask them for guidance, ask them for knowledge. And what we have seen in India is we have a society where people are willing to share knowledge, willing to show younger people like us the path in the world. And I think it's a big process of fulfilling your potential, of finding your way in the world, finding those gurus who say, I understand where you are. 20 years ago, I was exactly where you are. Let me tell you what is the path to simplification and specialization.
Fair enough. So this book is a tool, you have said. How will you advise people to go about using this tool in small doses or all at once?
Anupam, do you want to have first?
So, Ravi, I think what would be essential is to have to, and this is based on actual reader feedback that we've got, and we've been extremely lucky that some of the reviews that we've had on Amazon have been really helpful. There are people who've written blog posts detailing how they read the book and how the book helped for them. So I think there are two things. One is I would definitely recommend a first read throughout. I think that cover to cover reading would be very helpful to get a first-hand knowledge of the concept and of the framework that we've used. I think after that, the second step to my mind would be choosing the few chapters that are easy for you to adapt at first shot, and then take up the more difficult chapters. So the simplicity one is very easy to read and to understand, whereas the spirituality one tends to put off some people because they tend to associate spirituality with religion. That is never our intention or our case. We look upon spirituality more as a practice. So I think that reading the six principles first and getting that structure right would be the way to do it. I think one of the more effective ways, and it doesn't come intuitively to you, is to read the case studies. The case studies are designed in such a way to be standalone essays on their own. So I think that would be another way of reading the case studies all at one go to figure out how these successful people have figured out their life. And finally, the last point from my side would be notes. I think notes is something that's very, very useful. I don't know if people still do it. If you have a Kindle, highlighting is awesome. Kindle also gives you the feature to where they show you the highlighted portions in a text by other readers. And that kind of helps you to understand which are the recurring themes that people are connected to.
So, just a further point, Vic, at the end of each chapter, Ravi, you've given up the essence of the chapter in, say, 650 words. So, if somebody says, I really don't have the time or the concentration span to read the whole book in my first go, then a simple way would be just go to the end of each chapter. We've given you the essence of every chapter in 50, 60 words. And honestly, in an hour, you'll get the essence of the book.
Fair enough. If you were to advise organizations to adopt some of these principles, how will you do that? Organizations, corporate entities.
I'll take that first. I think the biggest challenge people face when they begin out in life, right? So there are sort of two groups of people. Let's start with the youngsters beginning out in life. When you start out at that stage of life, you're full of enthusiasm, you're full of energy, but you don't quite know what exactly will take you to the top. You want to go to the top, but the route to the top is not quite clear. And it's in that context that the guru or the mentor can actually play a very effective role. Whilst in social life and sort of my day-to-day interactions, I've found willing teachers and willing gurus. It's not clear to me that in corporate life, too many companies have created effective mentoring constructs, and which is ironic given that we are the country where the Guru Shishya Parampara was born. It's ironic that in corporate life, effective mentoring doesn't seem to be there in lots of companies. Too often, corporate life in India is about, well, here's a workstation and here's your tasks, crack on with it and impress us and rise in the world. Mentoring oriented corporate culture will certainly help, and the specialization chapter in the simplicity paradigm and talks very clearly about what the mentor's role can be if she is to give an effective mentorship. I think the second tranche point is the late 30s, early 40s, which is commonly called the midlife crisis, right? Where people realize that I've risen in the world, I've worked hard for 20 years, I've risen to a certain point. I don't know whether I'll make it to the top of the corporate tree. And hence, you know, what do I now do with my life? I'm successful, I'm wealthy by most definitions, but I'm not going to make it to CEO of this firm. And therefore, what do I do in life? Now, that's at that stage of life, there's even less corporate support and even less mentoring, right? And I think in that stage of life, obviously, the professional can reach out and read books like ours. But even more than that, I think looking at sort of senior corporate talent, people who are VP or even senior VP level, and saying, how do we get the most out of people now that they're in their last 10, 15 years of their life, they're soaked, they're rich with corporate wisdom in a country where high quality senior managers, and I've seen this as we invest across 30 odd companies across our various portfolios, high quality senior management in India is incredibly lacking. And therefore, it's a shame that we don't make the best of our managers who are in their, you know, late 30s, early 40s. And I think there's a real role for companies to step up and harness talent, not just in the early 20s, but also in the early 40s. Right? And in that context, the collaboration chapter of the book, the creativity chapter of the book, how people with diverse talents, what we call teams of rivals, teams consisting of very different individuals with very contrasting viewpoints can be combined to spectacular effect, right? The whole can be greater than the sum of the parts. And a lot of that, I think, depends on, can companies combine senior talent, which might not see eyeball to eyeball with each other, but which can be combined to spectacular effect. In fact, as we've said in the book, in the Victory Project, and as I've also pointed out in my preceding book, Unleash the Billionaires, if you ask, one of the biggest successes of Aditya Puriji at HDFC Bank was just this, his ability to harness different streams of talent to spectacular effect.
I remember reading that example of HDFC Bank. Would you say that is a common feature of all successful companies?
I think, you know, many of the companies and Unusual Billionaires do have it. Asian Paints has it. Increasingly, Pidilite over the last 5, 6, 7 years in the Bharat Puri era, as Pidilite is also demonstrating a lot of this. You know, I would love to say lots of companies have it, but Ravi, my reading of India is you're probably looking at maximum 15 companies in our country who are able to have a C-suite enlightened enough, mature enough, with emotional quotient high enough to gel corporate talent in such an effective manner. It's a very critical driver of success, I agree with you, but it's also not apparent to me that any more than 15 companies in our country have it.
So for readers of the Victory Project, what is the way forward? What other books will you advise people to read next? I know you have referred to a lot of, you know, within your book, but if you were to handpick a few for further reading, what would you recommend?
Yeah, so Ravi, the way I look at it is that I'm a big fan of corporate history. I was very, very lucky to play a small role for the Unusual Billionaire, which Saurabh had written. So I kind of use that also now when I was writing the Victory Project. I was again very lucky that Saurabh has, you know, gave me a chance out here. So anything that has to do with corporate history, there are many books that we've quoted out there. And this is India specific, whether it's Amul story, I Too Have a Dream, whether it's the Haldiram story, whether it's even the Reliance story by Himesh McDonald. So corporate history in India is not something that's covered fairly well. I think only in the last probably 10, 20 years have you got some books of some, you know, fairly good heft that have come up to chronicle that. And I'm saying Indian corporate history because that shows you how Indian entrepreneurs have succeeded staying here in this country over a period of time. And I think that for anyone, whether he's an employee or whether he's an entrepreneur, seeing their arc of success, the challenges that they've faced, the failures that they've faced, will give them enough perspective from a home ground view of how to succeed in life. So for me, it's, you know, all the corporate history books in India become a straight up must read. My personal favorites are all there in the book.
Sorry?
If I had to sort of choose my three favorites from the work that we put into write the Victory Project, I would say first off is Range by David Epstein. Because what he does in that is, I think it's quite spectacular book. He takes Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours, 10,000 hours of work to specialize in something, you know, to world-class level. He takes that paradigm and then he sort of expands it. He says that, look, if you just do one thing all your life, then you're not going to go very far because you'll be very narrow-minded. You just have one skill. So he creates, Epstein puts forward the T-shaped framework for expertise, right? Whether the stem of the T, the vertical part of the T is the 10,000 hours of expertise that Malcolm Gladwell has famously written about. But then the horizontal part of the T is what Epstein says is a width of knowledge, right? Read extensively, meet people from a variety of professions, have a variety of life experiences, right? You know, in colloquial terms, be broad-minded, so to speak, right? And it's that combination, the width of the T, the horizontal part of the T, with the stem of the T being the specialization. I think that framework from Epstein was a mind-blowing framework, and you know, we've described the power of that framework in the book and exemplified it by describing Bruce Lee's career as a martial arts artist. The second book, which I found very useful both for writing this book and for my personal life, is a book called Daily Rituals, How Artists Work by an American journalist called Mason Curry. So what Curry has done is he's described the sort of daily routines of 200 odd, you know, artists, writers, intellectuals, architects, statesmen, and so on and so forth. You know, what time they wake up, what did they do upon waking up, when did they do their high quality work, when was the writing done, when do they take their breaks, and so on. And what you realize, right, after reading, and I certainly realized after reading Daily Rituals, is a big driver of peak performance is routine. Right, having a daily routine within which you can live your life, right? It seems to be very, very powerful. Charles Duhigg has spoken about it in The Power of Habit, but Curry's book is because it's so vivid with examples ranging from Isaac Asimov to Ernest Hemingway, right? You almost sort of see the power of a routine, you know, coming in, jumping in front of you. And I found that very useful, and I live my life in as much of a routine as I can. Third book to highlight is Robert Greene's book, Mastery. How do you stage your career? How do you find your calling, your specialization? How do you find a guru? How do you work with a guru? How do you know when you need to move on beyond the guru? So his book, Mastery, is a comprehensive description of how to stage your career in a structured pattern and make the most of your talent.
Thank you. So that brings our discussion to an end. Thank you for your insights, gentlemen. It's a pleasure talking to you, as always.
Pleasure. Thank you for hosting us.